Hello, I'm Alok Jha, and this is Science Weekly from The Guardian. On this podcast, ever wondered how to save the planet but were too afraid to ask? Well, Chris Goodall knows what to do, and he's going to tell us how to do it. Plus,
that is the end of democracy. That is the beginning of a shift toward a situation where the government will get all the things it wishes to get. And it is an extremely dangerous route to step out on.
Why decisions on drug classification should be taken out of politicians' hands. And we look at the relationship between warfare and the medical treatments it requires and has inspired.
The best of human nature and arguably the worst of human nature. Every time we do something more dastardly, we need to come in and find another way of coping and putting our bodies back together, I suppose.
Also, something about lizards trying to impress the ladies with press-ups. No religion or atheism either. This show is all about putting the science back into Science Weekly. On the Guardian team this week are James Randerson and Ian Sample, science correspondents. Hello, both.
Hello.
Hello.
How are you doing?
Our guest is a writer and broadcaster on climate change and environment. He edits the carboncommentary.com website and is also the Green Party candidate for Oxford West and Abingdon. Welcome, Chris Goodall.
Hello.
Hi. Chris has just written a book called 10 Technologies to Save the World. So, Chris, the usual stories about climate change, about sea level rise and ice melting everywhere, they're all quite depressing things. And this book's kind of a wake-up call that there's ways to sort this out. This is all good news. So do you think the world can be saved?
I think it's an open question, but the point of writing the book was to show that we do actually possess the scientific and technological knowledge to stop emissions rising and eventually to get them to fall and to fall rapidly, which is what the planet needs. Crucially, the most important thing we can do is to invest heavily in research and development to get carbon capture and storage on our coal-fired power stations. That is the single number one thing. I talk in here about interesting new technologies for exploiting solar photovoltaic opportunities, but deep down, the most important thing we need to be thinking about is ways of stopping coal-fired power stations chucking truly enormous amounts of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere, not just in the first world, but in the developing world as well. We all hear stories about the rate of increase of Chinese coal-fired power generation. That is where the systematic problem comes. There's lots of things we can do in the West, but we've got to make sure that we have a solution for scrubbing carbon dioxide out of power generation systems.
And that technology exists. So the idea of taking carbon dioxide out of flues of power stations and somehow storing it underground to make sure that essentially your coal is carbon neutral. Yeah. But what are the sort of stumbling blocks to getting there?
Well, it's going to be massively expensive, and it probably adds about 30% to the amount of coal you need to burn to get a single unit kilowatt hour of electricity, because there's a lot of need for heat, which is parasitic on the power generation processes. Also, in the book, I talk about the possibility of using algae to capture carbon dioxide coming out of power stations. Algae are very much better at turning carbon dioxide into plant matter than conventional plants. They're much better, as it were, at the equivalent of photosynthesis. And we could use huge beds of algae outside power stations and bubble carbon dioxide or the flue gases through. And the growth rate of algae is so great that this can actually absorb large amounts of even huge power stations.
So a very efficient way of storing the stuff.
Yeah, well, the great thing about algae is that some species of algae can have up to 50% of their total weight in the form of oils. So we can take those algae, dry them out, crush them, and make usable liquid transport fuel from them.
James?
On the demand side of the equation, you have a chapter on super efficient homes, and I was very interested in some of the comments you were making in a feature that you did for G2, which was saying that the UK government's idea of trying to go for zero carbon homes is sort of, I mean, it sounds great, and on one level I suppose it is really good, but you're saying it's a bit of a distraction, that actually there are better things we can do.
Yeah, absolutely. Most Western countries are building approximately 1% new housing every year. I put that very badly. What I meant to say was that we've got 100 houses today. On average, around the Western world, we're building one new one every year. So even if we get all those houses to the most fantastically efficient standard, we're still left with the 100 that are completely completely terrible, particularly bad in this country. Of course, insulation standards are awful in this country compared to most of Northern Europe. What we need to do is focus on making those 100 much better rather than spending really rather large amounts of money making the one we're building every year absolutely perfect. The government's talking about having carbon neutrality. That means no net emissions whatsoever from new houses beyond 2016. That's going to cost a lot of money. It would be much better to spend that money upgrading existing houses, and it can be done much more cheaply.
Can I talk to you about renewable energies? The technologies that people might be familiar with, marine tidal energy or wind power, the number of windmills going up in the last few years has been phenomenal, and they seem to be a sort of very sort of ready source of clean energy. Do you see things like that as things like solar photovoltaics or solar thermal energy as the way that we're going to start resetting our energy balance in the Western world, at least?
Well, the opportunity to use solar energy is not great in today's grey London, but around the world, in the tropical parts or high sunlight parts, there is an extraordinary amount of solar energy hitting the surface every single second. We can power our needs, at least in tropical countries, from solar energy. In this country, wind is a much more efficient way of doing it. In the book, I try to address some of the issues about the intermittency of wind, which have made it seem as though wind is not a significant solution to our problems in Northern Europe. It is. We just need to alter the way we supply and demand electricity.
And ultimately, it is going to be the economics that make this happen.
Of course, it's all about business. It's all about pushing that technology so it gets cheaper and cheaper and cheaper to the point where it becomes inevitable that the businesses that are backing that new technology are going to drive out the businesses that are sticking with the old. I mean, in the book, there was one chapter on electric cars, and I think possibly in the period since I wrote that chapter, which is about 6 months now, more has happened with electric cars than any other single thing. It's now become absolutely apparent that the old model of internal combustion, petrol engine cars, is both extremely costly, very difficult for Western car makers to compete. We are getting a new industry. We're beginning to get electric cars out onto the road, and everybody now seems to understand that potentially the cost per mile is a small fraction of what a petrol car power is able to do. As a result, the world will move relatively rapidly. It's because electric cars are so transparently cheaper now that we're beginning to get massive, the kind of movement we need. That's not the case, unfortunately, in some of the other renewable technologies I talk about.
All right, well, Chris, we'll come back to you at the end of the programme. Chris Goodall's book, 10 Technologies to Save the Planet, is out now. Now for a quick look at some of the other stories making headlines this week. Ian and James, take it away.
News Jam.
European Space Agency has agreed to establish its first British space facility. The centre near Oxford could be up and running within a year. It will specialise in climate modelling, robotics and ways to apply space technology to more down-to-earth applications. But some academics say the facility could sap expertise from universities across the country.
A scheme to boost fuel economy by 20% is being met with scepticism from academics. Professor Ronjia Tao of Temple University in Philadelphia claims he can increase efficiency by applying an electric field to the fine spray of fuel as it's injected into an engine's combustion chambers. Tao says the electric field makes the droplets smaller, leading to better combustion.
And in noisy forests, lizards attract attention by doing push-ups. Researchers built robotic reptiles that mimic the animal's movements and found that the eye-catching shows made real lizards pay more attention. In the wild, Puerto Rican anole lizards perform the push-ups before sending out more complex signals by bobbing their heads up and down and unfurling flaps of skin beneath their chins.
Ian and James, thank you both very much. Ian, let's talk about the European Space Agency's facility in Harwell, near Oxford. There's a slightly less positive thing sort of buried underneath that, which is to do with the Copernicus satellite system. Do you want to just take us through that?
Yeah, so the name of this network of satellites sort of fluctuates between being called GMES and Copernicus. I think that at the moment they're still talking about it as GMES, although some of our ministers don't know that. The original idea was to have over 100 million pounds going into this from the UK. So it's a big project to do a whole network of satellites monitoring climate from space. They got 82 million, so pretty much a 40 million shortfall. But the scientists I spoke to were saying that it was probably enough to still make a good job of it. What it might come at the expense of is Britain actually taking the lead role in making one of these satellites. And I think there's more to that than just kudos and pride. I think there is sort of technological sort of advantages that come from being the person who says what happens on running one of these projects. And also, presumably, we would get, if we were taking the lead, we would get more contracts coming to Britain in doing that. But that is up in the air at the moment. That will probably be sorted out this week or next. Generally, that is a good story. I mean, that project will still go ahead.
The interesting thing about that, I suppose, is that the 128 million, I think, which is what the UK was supposed to give, according to its GDP, which would mean it would have a leading role, and the 82 million it did get, comes at a time when the Climate Change Act has just come into law in the UK. It's the first Climate Change Act in the world. It sets specific targets for carbon reductions. And GMES, the European system, is all about providing data for policy. And the whole point of GMES, Copernicus, is that you measure the various gases in the atmosphere and chemistry going on so that you can then specifically say these should be the targets in the interim to try and get this the CO2 levels down. Chris, do you think that the rhetoric that the government has on climate change, the idea that we've got this Climate Change Act that, you know, the climate, the renewables energy bill last year was talking about how we're going to have all sorts of wind power everywhere. Do you think that matches what really goes on when it comes to money?
We've had in the wings a competition for carbon capture and storage plants amongst the large power operators running for, well, discussion of it running for 18 months. We still don't have a budget allocation for that. What I think is the single most important R&D project facing this country, and we can't be sure when or if it's actually going to happen. That's an indication of the lack of ability of government departments to lever money out of the Treasury for any of these things. And my goodness, climate measurement is important. I think a lot of us are talking about climate change. Most people accept it's happening, but the models of the climate are still inadequate for detailed understanding of what's likely to happen as we increase the levels of concentration of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere. I think it's important, even for the most ardent supporters of the climate change mitigation policies, to recognise that we still don't know a heck of a lot about the climate, and investigation into what's happening in the atmosphere is an important part of the panoply of measures we need to put in place.
Let's move on to something else. The lizards, a little bit lighter, perhaps, Ian, with the lizards doing press-ups. Is this really to impress girl lizards?
No.
Where did that line come from?
I have no idea where that line came from.
That was produced Randy there.
But it's not too far off. I think this is the equivalent, the lizard equivalent of banging a glass with a fork at a wedding to try and get people's attention before you give a speech. What they do is when the forest environment is very noisy, not only in terms of sound, but also visually, if the wind's blowing, there's lots of stuff blowing around in the air. Lizards do these very elaborate big movements, and they happen to be push-ups. They're four-legged creatures, and it's a kind of easy thing to do if you're stuck on a tree and you've got four legs. Going up and down and moving your whole body is probably the most elaborate movement you could, well, apart from sort of breakdancing or something, it's one of the most elaborate movements you can make.
Do we know if it works?
Yeah. Well, scientists have seen this movement going on in the wild, and they had their hunches about what it meant. But what they did was design these robots to do it and then look at how other lizards responded to that. And they were being far more observant. As soon as the robot lizard started doing its push-ups, other lizards sort of orientated themselves to look and watch to see what was coming next. And that's when the more subtle signal of the head bobbing and the unfurling of this neck flap happens.
James is desperate to say something about this.
Well, I just wanted to let listeners know that you can see the lizards in action, and in fact, mechanical lizards in action as well, on
the website.
The Guardian's website.
Well, for everything you want to know on all of this stuff, go to guardian.co.uk/science.
Science Weekly from guardian.co.uk with Alok Jha.
A new exhibition has just opened at the Wellcome Collection in London. Called War and Medicine, it analyses the links between conflict and how the treatment of soldiers has changed over the past 200 years. Ken Arnold runs the exhibition.
There is an ironic way in which medicine has, you could say, benefited from warfare. But this exhibition shows that it is a more complex relationship, that medicine is part of the war effort, that when you apply science to warfare, one of the areas of science that you draw on is medical science, and therefore there's a way in which fighting battles has benefited from medical input, as well as the sense in which medicine has benefited from what doctors have been asked to do, what doctors have wanted to do during warfare to cope with the trauma, the bodily abuse around them.
So just talk us through some of the advancements that, war has been responsible for in terms of medicine.
Well, the first part of the exhibition looks at particularly the Crimean War, where really I suppose the question there was, how do you organise huge groups of people and keep them alive as well as keeping them fighting fit as soldiers? So one of the things that was developed during the Crimean War was this idea of organizing hospitals, of making hospitals actually places where people didn't die but were kept alive. So of course Florence Nightingale had a huge campaign around the hygiene and around the organization of hospitals in order to make sure that they were places that genuinely allowed people to get better, rather than what she discovered, which was that most people in the Crimean War were actually dying of infections. So the battlefield was a far less dangerous place to be than the hospitals. Another major development during the Crimean War is this idea of triage. So a Russian surgeon called Nikolai Pirogov, who really developed the system of grouping the injured according to the severity of their injuries. So the ones that are mildly injured, the ones that are majorly injured, and of course the ones that are dead. And then counterintuitively, you need to deal with the ones who only have mild injuries first if you're interested in getting people ready to fight again. So of course, instinctually, you think, let's go and deal with the people who need us most. But actually, during warfare, it's often the reverse. And then also, just the small issues one would think, but like food. A French-born doctor who worked with the English called Alexis Soyer, who really just came up with very simple ideas like portable stoves that could cook food readily and easily. Other advances in terms of direct medicine happened particularly in the First World War and the Second World War, so you could argue that plastic surgery was almost invented around the repercussions of warfare as weapons became more sophisticated, and particularly weapons that had terrible effects for people's faces, literally pulling their faces apart. So doctors became more and more audacious in what they could do, both withdrawing skin from elsewhere in the body, but also reconstructing people's faces. And then, of course, prosthetic limbs, so false limbs to replace limbs that had been blown off during warfare, particularly again in the First World War and into the Second World War, of making limbs, A, that look more and more lifelike, and B, that actually begin to function as real limbs. And then coming forward to today, when you actually have intelligent limbs that can respond to sensors at nerve endings that can really begin to help people walk upstairs rather than just be an impediment except on flat land. And then finally, you could argue that psychiatry was, well, if not invented, then propelled in a hugely important way after the First World War. So shell shock really is a moment for doctors to focus on the mental repercussions of warfare, and that's led to a huge number of advances.
You mentioned triage and the ethical issues that brings up. I mean, there are a lot of ethical issues involved in warfare and medicine.
Yes, this exhibition is undoubtedly the most ethically complex and difficult show that we've worked on. Everywhere you look, there's some very big questions, and I don't think we're seeking to answer them, but they are things that we should all be thinking about the role of doctors in warfare. There, the Religious Society of Quakers, for a while, we're really wondering whether they should campaign against doctors being involved in warfare because of this sense in which they might therefore be seen as being complicit, you know, as encouraging warfare. But on the other hand, I think most people feel, and certainly all the medics involved in warfare feel, as though it's their job to do absolutely all they can.
Ken Arnold from the Wellcome Collection there, speaking to producer Andy. And there's more from that exhibition in our Guardian Daily podcast. Go there to hear from David Cottrell, a contemporary artist who spent time filming British medics in Afghanistan. That's at guardian.co.uk/guardiandaily. The power to decide the classification of illegal drugs should be taken out of the hands of the Home Secretary. That's one of the proposals being considered by the government's Advisory Council on the Misuse of Drugs. Instead, the decision should be given to a small independent committee of experts. This classification committee of scientists, social scientists and experts in the drug field would decide which class drugs should occupy based on evidence of harm they cause to individuals and society. The committee was told that the system needed to be reformed because drug use has changed so much since the Misuse of Drugs Act was brought in 1971. James, you were at the ACMD meeting. What was said?
Well, sort of the background to this is that the drug classification system at the moment is basically a kind of evidence-free zone, and that was the view of the Parliamentary Science and Technology Select Committee. And the person putting forward this view is Sir Gabriel Horne. He's a professor of behavioural neuroscience at Cambridge University, and he chaired a report on the classification of drugs for the Academy of Medical Sciences. And basically he's saying when the Misuse of Drugs Act came in 1971, cocaine use was 30 times lower, and the number of deaths due to injecting drugs was 80 times lower. And he's saying, you know, it's failed, and we are in a totally different world now. We need a different way of doing things. Well, I spoke to Gabriel Hall and asked him a bit more about what he was proposing.
It is possible now systematically to take into account public opinion, and we did that in our public engagement programme for the working group with which I was involved, and we had absolutely no difficulty incorporating their views. They were very, very effectively expressed and immensely valuable to the working group. Now, the second point that, for me, perhaps is the most disturbing feature of all, and I do emphasise that I'm not taking any role in where cannabis should be, because that is not my remit and I'm not an expert on this. From reading the newspapers, your newspaper and other newspapers, it appeared that the a decision had been taken at the very highest levels in government that cannabis should be classified to be before the advice had been received from the committee. I think that is a very, very unwise step. I think it is a dangerous step. And especially there is the risk, given that the Advisory Council is largely appointed by, is indeed appointed by the Home Secretary, there is the risk that the Home Secretary may choose in future individuals who will reflect the intended government policy without any consideration of evidence. That would have two things. Two consequences. One, it would lead to the utter disenchantment of the scientific community. And by scientific community, I am including social scientists and philosophers and lawyers and economists. So I don't see science as being restricted. It cuts right across society. It would so disenchant them, they may very, very well say, well, what is the use of all this work we put in? And it's all done basically for free. These people, myself included, do these things because of a responsibility to, sense of responsibility to our society, ourselves. I'm quite confident that in the future we're going to see psychoactive substances that are far more specific and far more selective, and they may not just give people a buzz, they may have a profound effect on their abilities to think clearly. I do think we need independent people to look after the concerns of the nation.
Gabriel Horne of Cambridge University there. Ian?
There's a question here of accountability. I mean, now our Home Secretary, Jackie Smith, is accountable for cannabis being Class B. If this is a committee of independent experts, presumably these people will actually... there's always a chance some of those people will be getting funded from, you know, various sources which people might want to know about. And I wonder whether the accountability just becomes blurred in that sense and whether that matters, I don't know.
Chris, would you want to see a system like this adopted?
I think it's a very complex issue. We had the same sort of thing come up this week or last week over presumed consent for organ donation, where it looks like the government is going to reject the carefully thought through report of people who know what they're talking about and who've gone and looked at the impact of presumed consent on organ donation rates. They, to me, were quite convincing, the people who wrote this report, that presumed consent did not raise donation rates. Hasn't raised it in Spain, for example. The issue for me is the systematic undermining of science. If you have politicians saying pretty openly that these scientists may have looked at this carefully, but they're all fools, then, as Sir Gabriel says, you are going to get scientists sort of turning off from the political process. And keeping people who know, experts involved in government, is an important part of the way democracy works.
Ultimately, though, it's got to be accountable to someone democratically elected, whoever the experts are.
Yeah, but the Monetary Policy Committee isn't. So why do we think that scientific matters can be different?
Notwithstanding, arguably, their massive failure to spot the biggest financial collapse since the 1920s, which leave that aside, before that, people seem to be quite happy with that system. And as Gabriel Horn is arguing, you know, the heat had been taken out, the political heat had been taken out of interest rate decisions. And people seem to say, well, OK, these clever guys know what they're talking about. They make the decisions. So it is interesting that we seem to have a slightly different attitude to these two different problems.
Yeah, I think it's too easy, frankly, for politicians to ignore science across a whole spectrum of things.
That's a good point to stop that there. For more of this stuff, you can go to guardian.co.uk/science.
Science Weekly.
Back now to Chris Goodall, author of 10 Technologies to Save the Planet. We've got a new president-elect of the United States who is making all the right noises, it seems, in terms of green technologies, renewable power, etc. He wants to create millions of green-collar jobs. He wants to help the US and the world come out of this financial depression via these new industries. How optimistic are you about what's going to happen in the States?
The striking thing is about the United States that it has continued extraordinary entrepreneurial vitality across a wide range of industries. What's going on in renewable energy in the United States puts the rest of the world into shame. So although for the last 8 years we've had a president who's come close on occasions to denying the existence of climate change, perhaps not now, but perhaps in the past, nevertheless, industry, individual entrepreneurs, technologists, scientists in the United States have been pushing hard, and the rate of progress is enormously fast. And I suspect that politics can help that. But underlying the rate of change in the States is the fact that large numbers of people see enormous profit opportunities here in the low-carbon world. And let's hope that the new president will put in place fiscal and monetary measures to make that happen more rapidly.
Chris, can you take us through the scale of this this new opportunity out there for clean tech stuff, especially energy generation things? I mean, right. What's already out there? What are the big projects that our listeners could go and look at and think, well, at least there's something going on, that someone's doing this. There are hundreds of megawatts being produced like this somewhere. What would you point out? Well,
I think we should talk about solar thermal technologies, which is part of the chapter in my book on solar technologies more generally. What do we mean by solar thermal? We mean using highly reflective parabolic mirrors, long hundreds and hundreds of meters of them, focusing the sun's rays onto a thin tube of liquid, which heats up to 500 degrees or more. It's passed through that tube and then actually is used to power a conventional steam turbine. Now, that technology is being heavily invested in by Spanish industrial companies, and partly in Spain, but also partly in North Africa, which has, of course, massive resources of sun. In the United States, it's happening in the Southwest. And what we've seen over the last couple of weeks is a couple of power generating companies giving up the idea of trying to use coal for power generation, but instead focusing their intentions on solar, large-scale, kilometer-size solar thermal plants, which look as though they're going to be able to produce electricity at roughly the same price as fossil fuel. And the great advantage in the Southwest United States is you're getting most of the energy being produced at late afternoon, when demand for electricity in the States because of air conditioning is at its highest. So this technology is not only relatively cheap, but it also matches the distribution needs of countries like ours, which are entirely dependent upon ready availability of electricity.
And the other advantage, I suppose, of solar thermal is that you can do it in deserts where the land is fairly cheap anyway. You don't need areas of land.
If you go on the web to the project called TREC, T-R-E-C, put Trek Solar Thermal into a search engine, and you'll come up with this extraordinary idea that we devoted 100-kilometre square area of the North African desert, the Sahara Desert, to the production of electricity using solar thermal technologies. We could generate enough electricity for the whole of the 15 first countries of the European Union.
How much time do we have to get all this stuff done?
You guys know more about this than I do. My sense is that we might well already have a concentration of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere which will produce wholly unmanageable degrees of disruptions to our ecosystems and the ability of human beings to live on this planet. But I'm a pessimist, you know. There's people who say that we've got another 10 years, you know.
You're a pessimist, but the book's all about the optimism.
The book is saying, look, there are things which are either viable commercially today or within sight of being viable commercially today that can adjust our emissions enormously. I say in the book that we individuals in Europe consume constantly 5 kilowatts of power, of fossil fuel power of one form or another. We need to get that down to no more than 500 watts, a tenth of what we are at the moment. And the technologies in the book show in entirely believable detail exactly how we're going to do that.
Chris, thank you very much. And that's it for this week's show. Our thanks to Chris Goodall for coming into the pod. His book, 10 Technologies to Save the Planet, is out now. Thanks also to James Randerson and Ian Sample for their witty words of wisdom. Don't forget to add your voice to the debate at guardian.co.uk/scienceweekly. This podcast was produced by Andy Duckworth. I'm Alok Jha. Thanks for listening.